at Perimeter. I really enjoy the time, so thanks to the ICE and the other organizers for inviting me here. So I want to talk about some of the issues with firewalls that are proposed to exist near black holes. But I thought I'd show you an actual picture of a firewall I have here. It's a pyroclastic explosion of lava coming out over a big crack that looks like it's a kilometer long. This is on a flight I took from Vancouver to Seoul, Korea. And this is Kamchatka. It's a Kizimen, K-I-Z-I-M-E-N. If you're not from Canada, Z means Z. So you can look it up. I put a post on the Wikipedia article for Kizimen, so you can look up the details about it. Okay, so my graduate student Kento Osuga and I give an explicit toy qubit transport model for transferring information from the gravitational field to the Hawking radiation by continuous unitary transformation of the outgoing radiation in the black hole gravitational field. I should say, this model has no firewalls or other drama at the event horizon, and it fits the set of six physical constraints that Giddings has proposed for models of black hole evaporation. And indeed, it's very much inspired by his work. It's this kind of a one particular offshoot of Giddings' beautiful attempts to describe black hole information by some non-locality. And it does utilize non-local qubits for the gravitational field, but assumes that the radiation interacts locally with these non-local qubits. So in some sense, the non-locality is confined to the gravitational sector. So that's the kind of avoid problems of having big violations of unitarity in ordinary quantum field theory. Now, this qubit model is too crude to be quantitatively correct for the detailed spectra of the Hawking radiation. It fits qualitatively with what is expected. Okay, well, let me give just a brief review. So black hole information, as you know, is one of the greatest puzzles of theoretical physics from the 20th century that has persisted into the 21st century. So after Stephen Hawking discovered black hole evaporation in 1974, in 1976, when he was visiting Caltech and I was a graduate student there, he predicted that black hole formation and evaporation would cause a pure quantum state to change into a mixed state, effectively losing information from the universe. Now, when I was a graduate student, and even when I was a postdoc with Stephen Hawking from 76 to 79, I didn't question this. It all seemed to make sense. But then I got a position at Penn State University in 1979, and I was invited by my alma mater, William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri, which is also the school that Don Maroff went to. So there's two Dons in quantum gravity from that same school, and our professor was Don Gilker. So anyway, I was invited to give a talk about it. I was going to give a talk about predicting the unpredictability of black holes, and I looked at Hawking's argument. I said, I don't really believe all this because it believes the semi-classical assumptions. And I found one way in which it broke down, which is a Brownian motion of the black hole, although I wasn't of the opinion that that would by itself would solve the problem, but at least would show the semi-classical approximation breaks down far before the black hole gets to the Planck scale. Well, in 2004, Hawking conceded that black hole evaporation does not lose information. But there are a number of people, I think a minority, although but people like Bill Unruh and Bob Wald and various others that of gravitational theorists have not accepted Hawking's concession. So it's not really a settled question, but at least people from string theory seems to have gone over to the view that information is not lost. Now, there do remain many puzzles about black hole formation as to how it gets out, if indeed it does, and whether there are firewalls at the surface of old black holes that would immediately destroy anything falling in. And in particular, this issue of firewalls came up a few years ago, and now Harry Maroff, Polchinski, and Sully wrote this famous paper giving a provocative argument that suggests that an infalling observer burns up at the horizon of a sufficiently old black hole, so the horizon becomes what they call a firewall. And in very brief form, the argument is that unitary evolution suggests that at late times, the Hawking radiation that's gone out is maximally entangled with the remaining black hole and its neighborhood, including the modes just outside the horizon. And so this suggests that if everything around the black hole is maximally entangled with the radiation, they can't be entangled with each other. And so this suggests that what's just outside the horizon cannot be significantly entangled with what's just inside. But without this entanglement, then you'd have fields fluctuating independently just inside and outside the horizon. You'd get huge gradients. This would produce enormous energy densities. and an observer falling into the black hole should be burned up by this high energy radiation. So now a firewall at the surface of a black hole would be, as seen by an infalling observer, like a shockwave, giving a sudden huge increase in the energy density and curvature, perhaps the Planck values. Now, some people say this is a violation of equivalence principle. I'm not sure it's directly ruled out by general relativity, because general relativity does allow shock waves. It's not, strictly speaking, a violation of the equivalence principle, because if you go to anywhere before you get to a true singularity, you go to a scale much smaller than the inverse of the square root of the curvature, and you can get a local Lorentz frame. But it would be very surprising. I mean, similarly, it would be consistent with general relativity, with all our past observations, for a strong shock wave to be coming to destroy us without warning in the next few minutes. But we don't expect the state of the universe to include such a surprising shock wave. And, well, actually, we'd probably get destroyed so fast we wouldn't have any time to feel surprised. But if I were, you know, if I were told by some reliable source that maybe God tells me that this is coming, I'd be very surprised at this. In fact, I might be so surprised I'd be questioning whether it's really God telling me this. But but anyway. Pardon? No, I haven't gotten any. No. I haven't gotten any inspiration. So I think most gravitational physicists, I think, are highly skeptical about the existence of firewalls, at least for most black holes in the actual state of the universe. But there's a challenge of finding good arguments against them. So here I wish to summarize one general objection to the argument for firewalls, and then three arguments I've originated against firewalls and worked out with various people. So the firewall argument asserts that the following four assumptions cannot all be true. One, that black hole evaporation is unitary, or no loss of information. And then there's kind of an implicit one that people point out, that black holes have a finite number of states, and let's say it's the exponential of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And then three, that local quantum field theory applies outside the horizon or outside the stretched horizon. And then four, that there are no firewalls. So they say these are inconsistent, and the firewall argument is that assumption four is the most plausible to give up, thus leading to the conclusion of firewalls. However, it seems to me that almost certainly quantum gravity is non-local, so that assumption three appears to me far more plausible to give up. Well, one simple argument for this, in fact, is in particular the energy and angular momentum of a quantum state is recorded in the gravitational field at infinity by the constraint equations. So let's suppose you maybe you have a box like Auntie de Sitter space, and it's plausible, just to make the argument simple, I'll make a plausible thing, that the energy and angular momentum eigenstates are non-degenerate. So for a given energy and angular momentum eigenstate, that there's no other state that has exactly the same energy and total angular momentum is spin. The direction could be different, of course. Then you can't change the state at any location without changing it at infinity, because any change would change the energy and or angular momentum. So that's different from ordinary quantum field theories in a fixed background, where we can construct smeared field operators, a Hermitian combination of smeared field operators here, and multiply by I and exponentiate, you get a unitary operator. So you can have your original state, and then then apply this unitary to the state, gives a new state, and they both have exactly the same expectation values for space-like separated things. So in other words, in ordinary quantum field theory, there's changes, there's theoretically possible changes of the state that don't have no effect over here, but in gravity, it seems like any change would change the state all the way out to infinity. So I'm very skeptical about three, but then it's a fairly good approximation. So how, you know, that's the mystery. Why do you go bad if you take a fairly good approximation and make it exact? Okay, now one argument I had against firewalls was, and an argument for excluding them, was excluding with what I called extreme cosmic censorship. So firewalls are shockwaves moving along the horizon. So they, as seen by a sequence of infalling observers, their intensity is exponentially decreasing to the future and exponentially growing to the past. So if you go backward, they would effectively become very high energy and effectively singular. So firewalls would be excluded if there are no singularities in the past, which is the case if the extreme cosmic censorship hypothesis were true. And so this is that I'm postulating that the universe is entirely non-singular, except for singularities inside black holes, which go away when the black hole evaporates.
Yes? But But fireballs form at some time when you form the black holes, right? It's not that they've existed eternally, right?
Well, no, but I'm just saying if you take that state after they form and use the Einstein equations to evolve backward, they would get stronger and stronger.
They would go become a star or something, right? We know that.
Well, okay. I mean, I guess if you violated Einstein's equations, maybe you could.
But you should, right? I mean, you wouldn't form them otherwise.
yeah. Okay, but at least okay. So maybe I'm just saying that if you do have Einstein's equations, then they would. Then you couldn't really have them at any finite time unless they were stronger before that. So, okay, well, this is what I'm suggesting. And then also another issue is without this exclusion, the number of quantum states for a black hole could be unbounded because you could have arbitrarily high numbers of, you could excite positive and negative energy modes inside the black hole. You could get far more states than that. So it seems like we need something to exclude all these extra states. And I'm suggesting that perhaps something like this can get it down to a finite number. And a similar thing you could apply for de Sitter space, but I don't have the time to discuss that here. So I'm suggesting it's impossible to form firewall states from non-singular initial conditions, or as people do with ADS-CFT, of sending in regular data from the boundary. Okay, I mean, that's an hypothesis for how you could get rid of it. Now, another problem with the firewalls, at least up until, well, I certainly had the impression that most people were saying that firewalls should not be seen from outside. They'd have no effect on the outside, but if you fell in, you'd hit them. But then at a conference in Kyoto, we began a paper that we finished a little later on naked black hole firewalls. And the idea was, okay, nobody has a real model of how the firewalls form or where they are, but if you postulate that they exist at a location determined by its causal past, by the form at some cause, that's a close estimate for where the event horizon would be expected to be, then future quantum fluctuations can change the location of the teleological event horizon. The event horizon depends on what happened in the future. So if there's quantum fluctuations in the future, it can make the event horizon back of the past different from what you thought it was. And this could happen in such a way that the firewall is outside the event horizon, making it naked, visible from the outside. Now, this was a bit analogous to a reductio ad absurdum. I was saying that, okay, it gets more absurd if you could see the firewalls. Now, some like Don Maroff said, well, okay, we knew this could happen, and they're not too upset that maybe occasionally under quantum fluctuations you could see it. Anyway, so it's not an airtight argument against it. It just says they seem less plausible, at least to me, they seem less plausible than before if they could be visible.
They form around the event horizon? Is that where they're expected to form?
Yeah, they're expected to be not outside the event horizon, but very close to the event horizon. So
outside the event horizon.
No, not outside. I guess the usual picture was not supposed to affect what you saw from the outside.
The stretch horizon, right? The stretch horizon is outside the event.
Yeah. Well, it's true they assume quantum field theory outside the stretched horizon, but okay, I'm not sure they rigorously assumed this, but the general picture was that it was not supposed to have any observable effect from the outside. Only if you were foolish enough to fall into a black hole would you get destroyed. And from the outside, it was supposed to just look like ordinary unitary quantum evolution of the whole thing. Okay, so in this paper, we to combat the impression that avoiding a firewall by avoiding the non-locality of quantum gravity would require unobserved non-local behavior, my graduate student Kento Nsuga and I proposed this qubit transport model. So in this, local matter quantum fields interact with non-local quantum gravity degrees of freedom. So the matter fields start out just outside the horizon, strongly correlated with the matter fields inside the horizon in just the right way to avoid a firewall there. So we start with the nice usual correlations that you'd expect in Minkowski space, no firewall, but then as these matter modes propagate outward through the non-local gravitational field, they lose their entanglement with the matter field modes and instead pick up entanglement with the quantum gravitational degrees of freedom of the black hole. So they sort of swap their entanglement. They were entangled with what's inside. As they go out, they interact with the gravitational field, the non-local mode, and they swap the entanglement. So afterwards, they're entangled with the gravitational. They've picked up that information, and then they're now entangled with what those quantum gravitational degrees were entangled with. So when the matter gets far away, they're then entangled with the black hole, you know, assuming this particular mode was itself entangled with the rest of the black hole. So Okay, so to describe it, we say, all right, let's suppose that the entropy is A over 4. That's an approximate. It's probably log corrections. So the number of states is that. And so it's the same as N of A over 4 log 2 qubits. So we'll imagine that the information of black holes given by these N qubits, and we'll assume that this state is rapidly scrambled by highly complex unitary transformations. So generically, a black hole formed by collapse will have these N qubits highly entangled with each other. Each one will be highly entangled with the rest. But we are assuming now that there's an additional N qubits of outgoing radiation modes just outside the horizon, and a third set of N qubits just inside the horizon. They're trying to go out, but gravity's pulling them in. So they're going to the horizon's going to split the things apart. And we assume that these two sets of qubits have a unique pairing, and that each pair is in the singlet Bell state that represents the vacuum state as seen by an infalling observer. So these two N qubits of radiation modes, they look like a vacuum. They give no contribution to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is just given by the original N qubits, or the number of states. So they don't count for the number of states. They're just forced to be in this. For physical reasons, they're forced to be in this state. So the infalling observer sees only the vacuum and no firewall in crossing the event horizon. But now the Hawking emission of one mode corresponds to one of these in-outgoing radiation qubits, radiation modes from just outside the horizon propagating to radial infinity. So as it propagates out, it interacts with one of the in non-local qubits representing the black hole gravitational field. So when this matter field mode gets to infinity, its quantum state is interchanged or swapped with the corresponding black hole qubit, and that's a purely unitary transformation. So meanwhile, this black hole qubit corresponding to each outgoing radiation qubit, it will have taken on the state that this outgoing radiation qubit had when it was just outside the horizon, and hence now it will be this gravitational qubit that's entirely entangled with this mode inside, and it'll form a singlet Bell state with the qubit that was just inside the horizon that was originally paired with this outgoing qubit. So this went out and exchanged information. So now this non-local gravitational field is maximally entangled with this, and that's in a unique Bell state. So this vacuum Bell state of the black hole qubit and the radiation qubit can then be emitted from the analysis without any loss of information, because the whole state is just a tensor product of that pure state, that very particular pure state with the rest. So you might say that each such vacuum Bell pair of the ingoing qubit and this non-local gravitational field, you might say it falls into singularity, but what hits a singularity in this model is a unique quantum state. So the net effect of the qubit transfer model is that the emission of one outgoing radiation qubit gives the transfer of the information of one black hole qubit to one Hawking radiation qubit. So as the radiation went out, it just interchanged the information. So now here it has the information that was in that non-local gravitational qubit. But rather than just saying that this transfer is non-local from the inside of the black hole to the outside, we are saying that the black hole qubit itself is always non-local, and the outgoing radiation qubit picks up the information of the black hole qubit locally. It travels out and locally it interacts and it picks up this information. So in this picture, we've separated the quantum field theory qubits of the radiation from the black hole qubits of the gravitational field. So we don't need to require any non-locality for the quantum field theory modes themselves, but only for the gravitational field. So this is, well, you know, I can't be sure this is totally right. I mean, presumably for graviton modes going out, then, you know, even if it's gravitational, they, you know, maybe they would act, they would behave locally, but interact with this non-local, whatever, this other gravitational thing. Anyway, the idea is that this is a picture with the non-locality of quantum gravity might not have much observable effect on experiments in the laboratory that focus mainly on local quantum field theory modes. So as long as we're not involving these non-local gravitational qubits, we would not see much non-locality. So in conclusion, whether or not black hole formation and evaporation is a unitary quantum process that preserves information is still a somewhat open question, though at least in the crowds that I've been around, it seems like the majority of gravitational theorists now seem to believe that information is not lost. I mean, Hawking has conceded a famous bet with Preskill and a much less famous bet with me about this. also much smaller. He would give me a dollar and I'd give him a pound. And so he gave me a fake dollar with Marilyn Monroe's picture on it. Of course, I treasure it much more than a real dollar. But anyway, Okay, so assuming unitarity, the Bekenstein-Hawking density of states and local quantum field theory outside the horizon leads to the unpleasant prediction of firewalls at the surface of certain black holes, a prediction that would seem to be even more unpleasant if quantum fluctuations in the event horizon can make the firewall naked, like the paper that the firewall wrote. And then how to avoid this prediction without grossly giving up local quantum field theory is not yet fully known. It's an open question, and Steve Giddings has made a lot of great advances in this. But perhaps extreme cosmic censorship and or qubit transfer of information with non-local gravitational fields of the black holes can help solve this vexing puzzle.
So I think one comment that Steve made yesterday, and I think you're what you're doing maybe in the same vein, is you want to be as conservative as possible. I don't
right.
know if you agree with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Radically conservative. And now the question is, of course, I mean, the idea of locality, now on one hand, we know quantum gravity is not local, as you mentioned. On the other hand, and everywhere around us, I mean, quantum field theory is a very good description, at least in this room, and it's based on locality as one of the principles.
Right.
So the question is that this type of non-locality that you are talking about, shouldn't we see it here in this room, and why or why not?
Well, I mean, if it involves a gravitational field close to a black hole, I mean, I don't know exactly how fast this transfer goes. We put in some silly ad hoc model that maybe it depends on the Kretschmann scalar and you know, the it gets transferred by the time the Kretschmann scalar goes down to...
Yeah, but you want to make things non-local, so Kretschmann scalar is not the only thing you have. You have all sorts of...
Oh, yeah. That's, no. I'm not saying it has to be that. I'm just saying it might be something that has an effect basically, you know, in this room. By the way, you were saying it does remind me that I appreciate giving that, because once Feynman told me that he referred to John Wheeler's radical conservatism. And so as Wheeler's academic grandson, being Kip Thorne's and Stephen Hawking's student, I'm happy to if that you apply the same.
I wonder whether you're conservative as you think you are. That's what.
Oh, okay. Okay, maybe I'm not.
Yeah. So two comments. First, I think this qubit model is sort of a nice model, you know, exactly for the kind of thing I was describing yesterday, where one is coupling effectively through the stress tensor,
so right,
locally to the, you know, effectively non-local effects of the quantum state of the black hole. So that's just to connect the two. That,
right.
You know, saying this is a nice qubit model for that. The second comment, you know, related to what was just asked, is that, you know, in some sense, the non-locality may be associated with the black hole, with the strong field of the black hole. And in fact, you see some aspect of that in the way that I was describing it yesterday, because you only get a significant effect from the large number of black hole states.
Right.
You only, without the enhancement from the large number of black hole states, in at least the way I was describing it yesterday, you don't have a significant effect. So that's a contributing factor.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, this maybe just is one way of sort of stating in slightly different language thing that you've done. I'm not claiming that this is overly original, but it just seemed to be a way of looking at it in which I'm sort of saying, well, maybe the non-locality is essentially in the gravitational field, and trying to emphasize that maybe we don't have to have that much non-locality in ordinary quantum field theory.
Is the qubit transfer model connected in any way with the idea that the information is already outside, stored in super translation and super rotation charges?
I don't. Yeah, it doesn't really use that. I don't fully understand that, but
me neither.
I do know, of course, if the information is really out there in the gravitational field, then there's no issue about it getting out, because it's just always out there. But if you view it that way, what seems slightly mysterious, at least to me, is that how does that information in the energy and angular momentum of the asymptotic gravitational field, how does that get into the Hawking radiation? Because we also think that it's not just that the information is already, I mean, I do believe it is always out there, but we also, in some sense, believe it gets into the Hawking radiation. Now, of course, it has to for the Hawking radiation to have the right energy and angular momentum. I mean, once the black hole evaporates, the energy and angular momentum is that of the Hawking radiation. So there has to be a connection. but exactly how does that information get into the Hawking radiation is the part that's still rather mysterious to me.
Well, the charges could be on the horizon.
So I mean, that's certainly a possibility. I must admit I haven't understood it well enough to see how it may or may not relate to this.
Okay. Well, a quick comment on that. I think there are arguments given separately that, you know, there are a large number of states, say in a black hole or in a region, that don't have an imprint on these charges necessarily. Right. So that would be a counterargument.
Any more questions? Just thank the speaker again.